It is Monday, January the 23rd. This is VOA's International Edition. So good to have you with us today. Coming up, the U.S. gets a new president.
In Washington, the change is now official. The Obama presidency is history. The age of Donald Trump has just begun.
We'll also look at the talks about tensions in Syria. Plus, we'll get the latest on the Mariah Carey controversy and see what's trending on social media. Everyone, I'm Steve Norman. Donald Trump became the U.S. president less than 3 days ago, and now he begins his first full week in office with an announcement that he will be meeting at the White House on January the 31st with Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto for talks on immigration and negotiating the North American Free Trade Agreement. And it was a busy weekend for Mr. Trump. On Saturday, he visited the Central Intelligence Agency headquarters, where he told those gathered that they would have his full support, trying to mend tensions over his previous criticisms of the intelligence community. The president reminded the CIA employees on Saturday of one of his campaign promises, going after the Islamic State, sometimes referred to as ISIS.
We have to get rid of ISIS. We have to get rid of ISIS. We have no choice. Radical Islamic terrorism, and I said it yesterday, has to be eradicated just off the face of the earth. This is evil.
Saturday also drew anti-Trump protesters. They took to the streets of many U.S. cities and, for that matter, around the world. Actor and activist Scarlett Johansson was in Washington for the Women's March with a message for Mr. Trump.
Support the men and women here today that are anxiously awaiting to see how your next moves may drastically affect their lives. Support my daughter, who may actually, as a result of the appointments you have made, grow up in a country that is moving backwards, not forwards, and who may potentially not have the right to make choices for her body and her future that your daughter Ivanka has been privileged to have.
Johansson was one of hundreds of thousands of people who gathered here in Washington to show their concern about Mr. Trump and his policies. Just after taking the oath of office on Friday, Donald Trump spoke to the thousands gathered on the west side of the U.S. Capitol. He vowed to act on behalf of what he called forgotten Americans. VOA's national correspondent Jim Malone looks at the peaceful transfer of power from Barack Obama to Mr. Trump and what it means.
I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear.
I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear.
Like every president before him, Donald Trump took a simple oath.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
Yeah! With hundreds of thousands of excited supporters looking on, Trump quickly signaled a new era of change in Washington.
We are not merely transferring power from one administration to another or from one party to another, but we are transferring power from Washington, D.C., and giving it back to you, the people.
Trump also had a message not only for Americans, but for those watching around the world.
From this day forward, a new vision will govern our land. From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first.
Trump invoked the image of closed factories and Americans forgotten by Washington. Much of his speech was aimed at his core supporters, to Stanford University expert Jack Rakove via Skype.
He's basically telling his vision, the American people, or let's say at least Trump voters, that they have been let down or neglected or even really betrayed.
Trump also appealed for national unity in the wake of last year's divisive election.
We must speak our minds openly, debate our disagreements honestly, but always pursue solidarity. When America is united, America is totally unstoppable.
Yet that political divide was on display Friday with scattered anti-Trump protests around the city, including confrontations with police. Trump takes office with the lowest public approval ratings for a new president in decades. But he's expected to move quickly on his priorities, which include health care and immigration, says John Fortier.
Going forward, he does have, in theory, the votes in Congress with Republican majorities to get many things done. But he has very difficult things he is tackling. The repeal and then replacement of Obamacare is something all Republicans want, but the details on how to do it are very hard to come together on.
Trump comes into office as an agent of change, but that has carried political risk in the past, says historian Richard Norton Smith.
As Woodrow Wilson famously said, if you want to make an enemy in Washington, try to change something. Well, those presidents who want to make big changes make that many more enemies.
In Washington, the change is now official. The Obama presidency is history. The age of Donald Trump has just begun. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Throughout Mr. Trump's campaign for president, there were moments when he and the news media were at odds, and that appears to be continuing now that he has become president. On the matter of freedom of the press and Donald Trump's relationship with the news media, my colleague Lori London speaks with Kathleen Culver, director of the Center for Journalism Ethics at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Here's Lori London.
It would seem that the level of concern among journalists has grown recently. Can you speak to that?
I do think that a number of journalists, particularly the White House Correspondents Association, did express concerns throughout the Obama administration about matters of access and transparency. I think President Obama has been quite skilled at using his own channels to reach the public and not relying solely on news media. I'm not sure that that's something that's particularly because he is Barack Obama, but because new tools and new strategies have developed during his time in office. I think part of what has people concerned now is Donald Trump's very open, very apparent hostility toward the news media and his use of those themes on the campaign trail to gin up his own supporters.
There was a CNN reporter that was told he was not getting a question because there were some concerns over reports that CNN had done. Is that the beginning of suppression?
I think it's virtually impossible to predict whether that is the beginning of suppression, but across the board, I have found Donald Trump very difficult to predict. I will say this about President Trump. He knows how to work all sorts of different media channels, including the news media, but he definitely needs them. He needs that mix. He needs coverage, and he's very savvy about how to use it to his greatest advantage.
What about the potential to move the White House press corps from where it is now and down the block from the White House? Does that matter, or can the press continue to do its job just as well?
Part of the reason that you want to be close to the West Wing is that you have access not just to the president or the press secretary, but you see what's going on, you see people in the halls, that sort of thing. So moving them away would be not just symbolic, I do think it would have effects, but that's not to say that the news media have to be in that room or in that press room to be able to do their job. In fact, if they see themselves as only operating from that location, then we all have a problem. We need much more dogged reporting outside of the White House to be able to really cover an administration and hold it accountable.
There's been a lot of talk about fake news. Is it important for journalists to report about fake news as far as an entity in and of itself? Is it fair that if someone says something isn't true, that makes it not true?
So the concept of fake news, quote unquote, is really important for us to pull apart. I like to say that journalism really needs to be in the business of specificity at all times, and particularly now. You saw Donald Trump, and I was astonished by this, call a CNN reporter, quote unquote, fake news. Some people may accuse CNN of bias, but it is certainly not fake news. So we should be specific. We should call something a hoax when it's a hoax. We should call it a conspiracy theory when it's a conspiracy theory. If we are criticizing it of bias, we should use that term. But we shouldn't just label everything fake news, because it allows people like Donald Trump to sort of weaponize that term and use it to evade perfectly relevant and perfectly justifiable questions.
When the news that's coming out of any particular administration seems to be more negative than positive, is it a journalist's obligation to look for positive things to report, to be in the so-called balance? Or would that, again, sort of be trying to shift the conversation away from what is truth?
So this is a really important concept, and that's the concept of false equivalence. And news media are justifiably accused of this fairly often. And it comes from an admirable instinct to be fair, but it's taking that fairness to too great an extent. So with global climate change, for instance, you know, we just had another record-setting Earth temperature. And with climate change, if you report it as some scientists believe humans are contributing to global climate warming, but other scientists don't, that's a false equivalence. It dramatically misrepresents the actual situation, which is that the vast, vast majority, approaching 100% of scientists, believe that climate change exists and that humans contribute to it. And so if you have this balance, well, one side thinks this and the other side thinks that, you have to actually make the balance itself fair. You're not being fair to both sides if you present both sides equally, when in reality they're not equal. The election would be a good example of where we could say that there was an equal split. We have real division in this country, and it's equal across these two candidates. You know, nobody walked away with sort of an impressive share of the votes. And so there you can have sort of a left-right balance, and that's a fair balance. But we shouldn't be in the business of saying A said X and B said Y, and therefore that's the truth. People can say things all the time that are incorrect. Either they're inaccurate or they're not placed in the proper context.
That is Kathleen Culver. She is director of the Center for Journalism Ethics at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, and she was speaking with International Edition's Lori London. A bit later in the program, we'll look at the online buzz about the news media and the Trump White House. But up next, Kazakhstan, the site of talks on Syria. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on the Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Salih, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Salih saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Syria's warring sides meet today in Kazakhstan's capital, Astana. Russia, Turkey, and Iran sponsoring those talks with hopes of making some progress toward ending the six-year civil war. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Middle East scholar Yasser Munif of Northeastern University what the prospects might be for these talks.
Clearly, there is a lot of tension between Russia on the one hand, and the Syrian regime and Iran on the other, because they have divergent interests in the talks. The Syrian regime and Iran feel that they just took over or took back Aleppo, and there is no need to make any concessions to the opposition, and that the infighting should go on, and they should take over major regions around the Damascus area and in the south and the north. And the Russian want to move from playing a major role in the conflict and backing the Syrian regime to a position of being host and a neutral power hosting the meeting and possibly a new agreement. And so there is a lot of tension between those powers. And I think that there is little chance that those talks are going to be successful because the Syrian regime has no interest in implementing the ceasefire and feels that they are in a position of power, and they've been very successful in Aleppo, and they want to pursue that momentum. Iran feels that they might be the new target of the U.S. administration over the Iran nuclear deal. And they want to use Syria as a bargaining chip. And so there is no need to make concessions right now because Iran is not getting anything from that deal. And the opposition is also split. Some of the opposition feel that those talks' primary objective is to push them to fight al-Nusra, al-Qaeda-affiliated group, whereas others feel that the priority or there is urgency to keep fighting the Sunni regime. And finally, the al-Nusra group is still very powerful in opposition areas and is present in most of those regions and can easily undermine any kind of ceasefire. So I think the possibility of long and sustaining the ceasefire are very weak.
Can Russia be an honest broker in these negotiations?
I think that's what Russia wants to do because it feels that it achieved its goals in Syria. And there is need to have a political settlement in Syria, and that the war is very costly, and Russia is undergoing a major economic crisis, cannot afford a very long conflict with the opposition, but behind the opposition, the Gulf countries and Turkey and so on. It's a very costly conflict for Russia. And so it's trying to find some kind of resolution. That's not the case for the Sunni regime and Iran, who think that they have other objectives. Iran is very frightened from the U.S. administration change of priority or undermining the nuclear deal. And obviously, the Assad regime feels that they can build on their victory in Aleppo and take over other territories. So there is a major conflict between Syria and Iran on the one hand and Russia.
Can this be a springboard for a resumption of the Geneva political talks?
So that's what the Russian, the Turks are trying to do. They're trying to have some kind of settlement or resolution on the military front. And the main negotiators in those talks are the military factions, the military leaders, not the political leadership, and that this would be a preparation for the Geneva IV talks in a few weeks. But if the current negotiation, ASNA agreement, doesn't lead to any kind of agreement, this will undermine the Geneva talk, and there wouldn't be any political resolution.
So success is important?
Definitely. So if the Russians are not able to impose a ceasefire, the opposition is not willing to agree on the ceasefire. And as I said, the Syrian regime and the Iranian have been violating the ceasefire since day one in the suburbs of Damascus and nearby the borders with Lebanon. So the Syrian regime is trying to violate the ceasefire. The opposition would like a ceasefire because it's in a position of weakness after the defeat of Aleppo, but has also warned the Russians that if the Russians are not able to impose that ceasefire, the war will go on.
Middle East scholar Yasser Munif of Northeastern University speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Like I mentioned earlier, there has been quite a buzz about the Trump White House team and the news media. The latest has to do with Trump spokesman Sean Spicer holding a press conference in which he took no questions and then took issue with reporting on the numbers of people attending President Trump's inauguration. In defending the way Spicer handled all of that, Trump advisor Kellyanne Conway used potentially new language to describe Spicer's description of that inauguration turnout. Here with all of that is G. Abby Lee. Hey, G.
Hi, Steve. Twitter users found Kellyanne Conway's use of the words alternative facts quite amusing and jumped at the chance to send us some tweets and make some memes. Here are some of the tweets that use hashtag alternative facts and got around 2,000 likes. Here's one. I used to date Beyonce. The iPhone features all-day battery life, and this one is poking fun at the short battery life of Apple iPhones. Last but not least, a meme of a boy telling another man, I cannot tell a lie, but perhaps I can interest you in an alternative fact.
Gee, I have to say those are quite funny. What else is trending out there?
Yeah, people are still talking about the Women's March on Washington from this weekend. Specifically, they're talking about the large turnout and where the protesters left signs after the march. Many people left their signs in front of the Trump Hotel and the White House.
Yeah, I see, G. Very good. Let's move away now from domestic politics here in the U.S. and see what else people are talking about.
There's a lively debate on Twitter on which TV show is better, Parks and Recreation or the American version of The Office. It started out by an entertainment account called Geeks of Color asking that question, and the verdict is people seem to like The Office a little more. And before I go, I also want to mention that people are sharing condolences for the two Major League Baseball players who died in separate car accidents. They are Royals pitcher Yordana Ventura and Andy Marti, a third baseman with the Atlanta Braves. Steve?
Yeah, that's right. Gee, I saw many of those tweets and postings on Facebook. Sad, sad news about those accidents. Many thanks to G. She is International Edition's G. Abby Lee. And by the way, you can find G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And our program, International Edition, can be found on Twitter at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Systems that prevent computers from being accessed by unauthorized users are becoming quite sophisticated. Among the tools being used to protect computers and valuable data include complex passwords, voice recognition, smart cards, as well as fingerprint, iris, and retina scans. Now, a group of researchers at the State University of New York at Binghamton have come up with a unique new way to protect electronic health records: the patient's own heartbeat. The patient's own electrocardiograph, or ECG, which measures the electrical activity of the heart with a biosensor attached to the skin, is what is used to actually encrypt the confidential data. Since a person's ECG may change at times due to factors such as age, illness, or injury, the researchers say that they are working on ways to take these changes into consideration. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Well, looking back a few weeks at the beginning of the year, well, you know, it didn't get off to a great start for singer Mariah Carey. VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald tells my colleague Jim Stevenson the fallout from her nationally televised debacle continues.
If you're lonely,
Jim, what started out as just a bit of a train wreck on live television has really turned into a much more interesting conflict centering around her very controversial manager. Mariah's entire professional career has been turbulent. Now, for those who don't know, back on December 31st, Mariah was appearing on the New Year's Rockin' Eve TV special. She encountered some problems, she said, with her earpiece. Mm-hmm. She couldn't hear the backing tapes. And she couldn't count on her backup dancers to give her the beats or the music because they were on stage with her dancing around her. So Mariah ended up just walking around with her microphone. She asked the crowd to sing. After a while, she pretty much just left.
All right.
This has morphed into something much bigger. Entertainment Weekly is reporting that Mariah has fired her creative director, Anthony Burrell. It was his decision to move the backing dancers closer to Mariah, and apparently she felt that that's what threw her off. And now Mariah's ex-husband has entered the fight. This is former Sony Music chief Tommy Mottola. Now, he wrote a statement in the New York Post urging Mariah to seek more seasoned and respected professionals to guide her career. Now, this is seen as a shot at Mariah's manager, Stella Bulochnikov. Now, Stella took over Mariah's career about a year and a half ago, and she's very outspoken. Critics are charging that she is isolating Mariah. A lot of Mariah's old team is now gone. So right now it seems to be pretty much just Stella and Mariah. And Tommy is saying this would never have happened when Mariah was with us at CBS Sony. Stella Biluchnikov responded by calling Tommy Mottola a relic, and she wondered if he'd delivered his message by rotary phone.
Ouch.
Yeah, exactly. Burn. So the question is, where does it go from here?
We're not any stranger to having mishaps during live performances. This isn't the first time that a performer has had to go through this, but my goodness, the social media explosion over this was phenomenal.
Well, yeah, and I mean, it's often done to have performers work with pre-recorded backing tapes. It's standard procedure more often than not. But a lot of Mariah Carey's critics said she could have handled it a whole lot more professionally. And this has certainly got people talking about her. And as you know, there's an old dictum that says there's no such thing as bad publicity.
Right.
So if you're into juicy gossip, this is a real motherlode.
Always on cue and doing a great show is our own Ray McDonald. He's our top 20 countdown host. You can hear him every week on VOA 1. And of course, he's out there on social media as well.
I'm out there stirring up trouble on social media at Ray on the Hits.
Follow all the trouble in the hits with Ray. Thanks so much.
You got it, Jim.
You know, you gotta say, Mariah's got an amazing voice. I don't know why she does all that electronic stuff. Yeah, if she just sings straight, what a range, like 52 octaves. It's amazing. Little Texas hyperbole there. 4 or 5 octaves. When she first came out, I gotta leave it alone. She was fantastic. Yeah. All right. More women are entering the field of animation. We've just found that out. One of the goals is to create more realistic female characters, they tell us. Not just those stereotypical nerds or sex bombs villains that dominate things now. Women depicted in animation these days typically fall into a handful of archetypal roles. That is the word from Erica Larson-Dockery, who teaches a class on the animated woman at California Institute of Arts. Listen, thanks for joining us here on The Voice of America. It's always good to have you with us on International Edition. Latest world news is straight ahead. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington, hoping you have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Among the most brutal and bloodthirsty members of the violent terror group Daesh, also known as ISIL, are a handful of men who communicate among themselves in English. This group of four, dubbed the Beatles for their heavy British accents, was put in charge of foreign-born hostages held by Daesh. These men are markedly more brutal to the prisoners than other guards, using extreme methods to torture the prisoners. To date, they have also executed by decapitation at least 24 prisoners. A number of these executions were videotaped and posted on the internet by Daesh. Alexander Aman Koti has been identified as one of the members of this group of British terrorists. Born in London, United Kingdom, in December 1983, Koti converted to Islam as a teen. Koti engaged in the group's executions and exceptionally cruel torture methods. Koti has also acted as an ISIL recruiter and is responsible for recruiting several British nationals to join the terrorist organization. The United States periodically identifies certain individuals that are of particular significance to a terrorist organization. In all cases, these are people who have committed or are deemed to pose a significant risk of committing acts of terrorism. Alexander Aman Koti has been identified by the U.S. government as such an individual. As a result, the U.S. Department of State has placed his name on the Specially Designated Nationals list. His assets within U.S. reach have been frozen. No U.S. citizen or company may conduct business with Alexander Koti. This action notifies the international community that Alexander Aman Koti is actively engaged in terrorism. Designations of terrorist individuals and groups expose and isolate organizations and individuals and assist or complement the law enforcement actions of U.S. agencies as well as other governments.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.
It's